So, at this point in the retreat, it's sometimes possible to turn more fully towards insight, wisdom, liberation. And I would like to recount to you the teachings from a particular sutta that offers all three, and which has a statement in it that I think is one of the more profound statements in the middle length discourses, maybe in all the suttas. Maybe it qualifies as one of the most profound one with the other 52 profound passages. So the profound statement that it makes is kind of like I see it as the climax of this particular sutta story. So I'd like to start at the climax, and then give you the rest of the teachings leading up to that again, so you know where we're going, in case it confuses you a lot when you hear it the first time. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, who translates this, has chosen, a little uncharacteristic for him, a poetic rendering of the Pali. It's not quite what the Pali says, but I think it works better. He talks about the tides of conceiving. The tides come and they go and wash you away if you get caught in the tide. Tides of conceiving. And the word conceiving, I think, is a very powerful term. But I think for people in kind of popular English, it might be more significant to substitute the word story for it. Because many of us understand about living in our stories, as opposed to living in our conceivings, like you have to scratch your head, and what does that mean? But living in your stories, caught up in your stories, that's clear. So I'd like to use the word stories. The tides of story-making, of stories, do not sweep over one who stands on these foundations that the text had talked about, we'll get to. And when the tides of stories do no longer sweep over one, one is called a sage at peace. And with reference to what was this said? Monk. I am is a story. I am this is a story. I shall be is a story. I shall not be is a story. I shall be possessed of form. I shall have a body is a conceiving. I shall be formless is a conceiving. I shall be conscious. Conscious is a story. I shall not be conscious is a story. I shall be neither conscious nor non-conscious is a story. Stories are a barb or a dart. The Buddha in somewhere else talks about he discovered that there was a barb, an arrow or a dart in his heart, and then he discovered how to take it out. The kind of this very simple way of talking about what he accomplished. Stories can be a dart. By overcoming all stories, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die, is not shaken, and does not yearn. For there is nothing present in such a one by which that one might be born. Not being born, how could that one age? Not aging, how could that one die? Not dying, how could one be shaken? Not being shaken, why should one yearn? A sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die, is not shaken, does not yearn. So when you get to be a sage at peace, will this be true for you after this morning's reflections? A sage at peace does not age, does not die. It's quite something, it's a statement. I think it's pointing to something very profound. Certainly it points to not identifying with the stories, and even birth, aging, illness, dying are all stories. And we often live in the story more than the actual condition. One of the great sages, teachers at the San Francisco Zen Center was a man named Isan Dorsey. And he died eventually of AIDS. I knew him. He was one of the most beautiful, radiant people at Zen Center, full of love. And he was also, for practical purposes, illiterate. Only thing he'd maybe managed to read as an adult was maybe parts of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So not your representative American bookophile. But he was dying of AIDS, and he said, to have AIDS is to be alive. That was his way of saying, not buying into the story. Some stories are true, but the fact that stories are true, does that mean we have to live in the stories? There's a point of view that birth, aging, sickness, death, as stories, are like when you live and tell those stories to yourself, it's like watercoloring, taking your brush and your watercolors, and painting a beautiful picture on a running stream. That's what, just already gone, but even before you even kind of, your brush goes more than a millimeter, it's already washed off. So this is this profound statement and the climax of the text. So now I'll build up for it, so you can maybe understand better. So it has a delightful story of a man named Pukkusati, who heard about the Buddha from a distance and was very inspired and decided to go find the Buddha. So he kind of became a home leaver, took on, I guess, the garb of a home leaver, a renunciant, and went looking for the Buddha, went going to Savatthi, where he thought the Buddha was. And he came to a potter, and had permission to sleep in the potter's shed for the night. And a little later that evening, the Buddha is also wandering around the countryside alone, and he goes to the potter and he says, would it be okay if I slept in your shed tonight? And the potter said, well, I don't know. There's already a wanderer, a renunciant staying there. I guess we'll have to go ask him. And so they went and asked Pukkusati, there's this other guy here, he wants to come and stay here too. Is that okay? And he said, oh, yeah, certainly, there's plenty of space for both of us. Then into the evening, it was through the night, Pukkusati sat up and meditated. The Buddha sat up and meditated. And some point late into the night, the Buddha was kind of impressed by Pukkusati. This is an impressive guy. He's serious. What's happening is Pukkusati, wants to go study with the Buddha, but doesn't recognize the Buddha. He's right there, right? And I love this story because, usually the Buddha is kind of like considered to be, radiant and light flashing and 16 feet tall and halo and, usually we think of him pretty special. And here, he was ordinary enough, ordinary Indian of his time enough that Pukkasati, he didn't, you know, he was respectful of this person at the shed, but he just didn't see him as someone, didn't stand out. Maybe the Buddha was an ordinary person who woke up, just like you are an ordinary person, and you can wake up. I think it's a little dangerous to put the Buddha, to make him too high up on the pedestal, and to think that it's some, you know, almost like the way it's often sometimes depicted is he's almost like a god or supernatural. It's just like he's like a whole other category, species almost, because, you know, just the powers and abilities. And here Pukkasati couldn't tell that he would, you know, just. So the Buddha was impressed by this Pukkasati. Buddha says to himself, "This person conducts himself in a way that inspires confidence. Suppose I were to question him." So he asked Pukkasati, "Under whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? Whose teaching do you profess?" And Pukkasati says, "Friend, there is a recluse, Gotama, son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan. Now a good report of that blessed Gotama has spread to this effect. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. I have gone forth under that Blessed One. That Blessed One is my teacher. I profess the Dhamma of the Blessed One." But, the Buddha says, "Where is that Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened?" And Pukkasati says, "There is, friend, a city in the northern country named Savati. The Blessed One is there." "But Bhikkhu, have you ever seen that Blessed One before? Would you recognize him if you saw him?" "No, friend, I have never seen the Blessed One before, nor would I recognize him if I saw him." Then the Blessed One thought, "This man has gone forth into home life, into homelessness, under me. Suppose I were to teach him the Dhamma." So the Blessed One addressed Pukkasati thus, "I will teach you the Dhamma. Listen, attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend." And then the Blessed One said this. Then he's going to give his teaching. So he still doesn't know who the Buddha is, but he's happy to receive teachings from the stranger he met. And remember, they've been sitting up meditating through the night. So the teaching that follows, I like to think of it as almost a guided meditation. Because Pukkasati's mind, I'd like to believe, was clear, malleable, soft, alert, present, receptive. Just right there. Right there. Concentrated. And the idea of there's a concentrated mind is very important, I think, for this, what follows. Because a concentrated mind is not a mind that's caught up in stories. A concentrated mind not only is not caught up in stories, but is not caught up in its thoughts. It's quite remarkable to get into a good state of concentration and feel the difference between a mind which is caught up in thoughts, involved in thoughts, mind which is thinking, because that's all there is, and a mind which is not involved in thoughts, and a thought arises, and it's like, why would you pick it up? Why bother? It's to my detriment. It's like a drag. Why get involved in something which diminishes me? Why get involved in something which will tire me? Why get involved in something which contracts me, that loses this peaceful, open, concentrated state that I'm in? It's quite something to watch that. So your thought comes up. No thanks. There's better things to do than to think. Isn't that great? So Pukkasati is that way. And so it's not just not having stories, but even the simplest stories aren't being said. So a real simple story would be that Pukkasati is a renunciant. I've left, or the Buddha is another renunciate and he's going to teach me. Or I have a body and my body is X feet tall and I have the, you know, I'm this kind of person and I'm from the north and he's from the south and, you know, or it can be, you know, just all kinds of very, very simple conceivings, ideas, notions that we overlay on our experience. Sometimes innocently, sometimes in a very useful way, but it's still an overlay on our experience. And so when the mind gets concentrated enough, that notions, ideas coming up that interpret, that describe, to label our experience, doesn't have to operate. And it's not, you know, it's not like in a concentrated state, you're not diminished by that lack. It's actually picking up the labels, picking up the stories, the conceivings. That's the diminishment in that state. It's just more peaceful, it's nicer. So here Pukkasati has been put down his conceivings, his ideas, his thoughts. And the Buddha is going to give him teaching. Now remember, the context of this teaching also is he doesn't recognize the Buddha. Sooner or later, he's going to discover who the Buddha is, and he's with the Buddha. And there's an opportunity here in this transition, in this time, to teach something very powerful to Pukkasati before he realizes who he's talking to. Because once he realizes who he's talking to, the overlay of conceivings, ideas, projections are going to come pouring out. He's not going to see that person anymore. He's going to see the Buddha who's so great. Now, the Buddha, I'm sure, was great. But it's more peaceful not to even think that. You know, why pick that up if you're in a really good state? So you can see something different. And you can start seeing something different than the usual stories we say about people, who they are, who I am, who you are. There's some whole other kind of perspective to be had. And I bet that part of Pukkasati's waking up was when he realized he was talking to the Buddha, the teaching he just received gave him a powerful lesson about what the mind does. So the Buddha then started this way. This person, interesting, says this person, so it's basically referring to himself, right? Consists of six elements, six bases of contact, and 18 kinds of mental consideration. So it's kind of sure I've lost you now. So what the Buddha is going to, and then he goes on and he says, the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon, one more. And the person has four foundations. So this person consists of six elements, six bases of contact, 18 kinds of consideration, and this person has four foundations. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over that person, he is called a sage at peace. One should not neglect wisdom, one should preserve truth, one should cultivate relinquishment, and one should train for peace. This is the summary of the teachings of the six elements. So I know it's a little bit cryptic. So what the Buddha is going to do is he's going to lay out a teaching on what is most fundamental or elemental. Sometimes it's useful to go below the surface of things, the diversity of things, and to look at what are the common elements or the common denominator of all things. What's the most important foundation? If you trace things to the building blocks that make up our world, the building blocks make up our experience of the world, just like, you know, atoms are basically, I don't know, electrons are basically the same everywhere you go, I guess, kind of. And then from these kind of subatomic particles, we can build this whole complicated different world, right, of many different things. But if you trace all this back, the atoms in our body are not much different than the atoms perhaps in the building here. There's, you know, so you can bring things down to the elemental level. And so we're doing that in Buddhist practice, the elemental level of our experience, the common denominator. Because if you can be present for the common denominator and have wisdom about it, then that wisdom is applicable in all situations, then it spreads out. So the Buddha first says there are six elements, six fundamental building blocks for our experience of the world out there. There is earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. And then there is six forms of contact. There's the contact through the eyes, contact through the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the contact that happens in the mind, so you can know what's going on in the mind. And so those things are actually fundamental. You don't know anything about the world. Everything you know about the world is channeled through a funnel. And that funnel is the sense contact we have. So you might have someone you're madly in love with or madly in hate with. It's the sense data that comes through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, that comes in and gets transformed into a story, into an image, an idea, based on memory, ideas, and all these things. But it all has to begin at the senses coming in. So that's fundamental. The whole world we create for ourselves starts there. And then there's six kinds of contact. There's six ways in which we make contact with this elemental aspect of the world. And when we make contact, there are 18 things to consider. The word is upavicharati, like vitaka vichara, vitaka vichara. Upa means like close to consider closely, think closely about, to be aware of, to focus on. So remember, this is like a guided meditation, right? So this guy is very still and quiet, and maybe he's listening to this, and he's actually following it along in his experience, not thinking about it. The Buddha says, on seeing something, one explores, or one considers, one a form productive of joy. When one considers some object productive of grief, one considers an object productive of equanimity. So I think what it's saying here that as we look at things, some of them produce liking, some of them produce disliking, and some of them we stay neutral, equanimous about. And one considers that these are the possibilities. It goes through the other, all six senses this way, which adds up to 18. So it takes a lot of mindfulness to be so present for experience that when you hear something, you recognize, oh, that produces joy, listening to that delight. That produces distress or grief or unpleasantness, and that's equanimous. So this is fundamental, and as Lee said, this kind of movement of vedana, for and against, is really basically built into our whole wiring. And so one considers this fundamental thing. Because here, so there's a sense data comes in, and what happens inside, how it's registered inside, is the next step in the building block for the world that we create. And it's quite something to be able to relax, be still enough, to watch right there at the building blocks as it occurs. Remember when I was in Burma, practicing there, I've been sitting, meditating for some while, and I went for my meeting with my teacher, Pandita, and I walked into his cabin, and then just on my going in on the right next to me was an altar, and there was a table or something, and there was a Buddha there that I hadn't seen before, and just was there, and so I looked at I kind of so. And I saw my mind go very rapidly. I saw my mind see the Buddha, experience it as pleasant, and then want the Buddha. I thought, wow, that was quite something to see that, how quick and rapid that, because normally I would have just walked in and wanted it. But I, to watch, how it goes on there. So to be quiet enough to see how this works, to see how this, then we get swept away, the tides of conceiving, is very useful. So in terms of the world that we live in, and our contact with it, and our stories we make about it, this is fundamental, this aspect. The elements, the contact with it, and what happens to us. But then he talks about, Vicca Bodhi translates as foundations. Other people call it determinations. So there are four fundamental inner states, qualities of being, qualities of mind, or states of mind, or determinations, resolves of the mind, which are fundamental. So just as this is fundamental to our world, the experience of the world, this is fundamental within us for people interested in the path to liberation. And these four determinations, or four foundations, are the foundation of wisdom, the foundation of truth, the foundation of relinquishment, and the foundation of peace. Or the determination for wisdom, the determination for truth, the determination for relinquishment, and the determination for peace. One should not neglect wisdom, one should preserve truth, one should cultivate relinquishment, and one should train for peace. And how does one not neglect wisdom? Then the Buddha begins again. There are six elements: the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element. So this is the fundamental building blocks of our experience. And then he goes on and talks about them. And in the modern world, we tend to talk about, first he talks about the earth element. We talk about it as the direct experience we have of hardness, softness. So there's all kind of different ways we experience hardness and softness. So if I touch the platform, I feel hard. If I touch my thigh, it feels soft. And if I touch the bell, it's hard. If I touch the platform, it's hard. And the basic sensual experience has this feeling of hardness and softness. So the same thing for water is or heat. Fire would be, you can feel coolness. If I feel this bell, it's kind of cool, but if I feel my thigh, I feel warmth. If there is water, if you feel the cohesiveness, the fluidity of your saliva in your mouth as you wash it around your mouth, you're feeling the water element. And they say that any cohesive feeling or fluidity feeling is the water element. The air element is any movement. So winds move, for example. So anytime you feel movement, if you feel gas in your belly moving, or if you move your arm, they say that movement, as you feel it, sense it, is the air element. Space is space, just the absence of things. And then the last element in this system is consciousness. Here, consciousness is something very simple. So he points out these six elements. And for the first five, he says something, the wisdom teaching. He says, these first five elements should be seen as they actually are with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So not to identify with in any way, not to take it as represent who you are, not to take it as possession, not to be defined by it. So it's kind of easy to do that with space. And you can imagine there's space, I don't know where the easiest space is to sense or imagine in your body, but maybe if you open your mouth just a little bit, separate your teeth a little bit, and keep your lips closed if you want. There's space there, right? And that space is not you. It doesn't make any sense to define yourself by it or identify it, or that's my essential self. And then you close your mouth and your essential self disappears. You know, there's space there. So to say space is not me. And there's all kinds of space inside. And they say we're mostly made up of space, right? And then are we the experience of temperature? So right now I'm hot. Some of you probably had the experience of having a sensation and switching how you perceive it, the story you tell yourself about it, from, for example, going from saying, I am hot, to just, there is heat. Sometimes that little extra, I am, is a heavy weight on the mind. It's part of the storytelling starts up, and we identify, we have pity, or all kinds of things. But just heat. So there's heat in the body. Is that who you truly are? And if you get cold, then you've disappeared? You know, it just there's heat, and there's cool experiences that come and they go, like the weather. Hardness, softness. Is that who you really are? The experiences of hardness and softness in your body, they come and they go. Lee was so nicely talked about what happens as you get older, and they say that the things that were hard get soft, and things that were soft get hard. And is that who you really are? You know, these things, that, you know, the hardness and the softness of it all? And so, you know, maybe you can begin sensing, you know, no, or you will soon enough. You don't want to, it's enough to identify with it. And so it goes, all these elements that, you know, start seeing at the fundamental level, before the story and the conceiving, the actual building blocks of our experience, that, you know, they're just experiences. They're just stuff that happens, they come and they go, and they're variable and change over time. And, you know, we don't have to identify or take them as me, myself, and mine. Interestingly, the Buddha doesn't say this for consciousness. He does something different with consciousness. And I don't know quite why, but I'll try to explain my idea. And that is that it's kind of like if you look at a movie and see some really glamorous person up on the screen, you fall in love or you fall in hate, you know, just this, you know, wonderful person. And is a person really exist up there? You can kind of say, no, that's not the person, kind of, but it's not someone else, right? If someone takes a photograph of you or puts you on the movie and they say, no, that's not you up there, well, it's true, it's not really you. You're sitting there in the movie theater watching a movie of you, but it's not someone else either. The whole idea of, you know, with movies, you can't really say self, you know, it's not quite me, it's not quite not me. So maybe let's not play the not me or me game. Let's not even be involved in looking at consciousness from the point of view, this is my true self, or this consciousness is not me. Maybe this is what the Buddha is doing here. Rather, what he does, he looks at the process of what is consciousness. And the way that this system works, again, is kind of like the movie. there is no movement on the movie screen. There's only still shots. But our mind processes images in such a way, rapid images, that we construct image movement in our minds. And I've been told there are some movie directors who have sharp minds and used to this, that they can look at certain frames per minute movies that other people see movement, and they actually see the still shots, you know, flashing very quickly on the screen. And so you know, if you slow down the movie enough, all of us will see the still shot. And so you see the still shot arise in that moment. There is seeing of operating, seeing of that shot. But then if there's a gap before the next shot gets put on, then there's no more seeing of that. That seeing has dropped away. So in the gap, so consciousness exists, seeing consciousness exists for a moment in the seeing, but when the object disappears, that seeing consciousness disappears as well. The seeing consciousness doesn't persist like a steady state. It arises in a passing depending on the input that comes in. So if consciousness exists, I consciousness only exists the moment we see something, does it make sense to say that's me? No, because I've disappeared when I stopped seeing it. But does it make sense to say that it's not me? You get a headache if you start thinking about these questions. So let's not play the self game around moments of conscious, moments of knowing of our experience. But let's see it as a process that arises and passes, arises and passes, arises and passes. And in that seeing of arising and passing of everything that we can know, all of every act of knowing, in there is found freedom. There's something about seeing the arising and seeing the passing, the seizing of something, where it realizes it doesn't make sense to hold on to it, to grasp onto it, to resist it, to put our hat on it, to do anything with it, to identify with it, to not identify with it. Just let it be, in that letting be. And what he says here is that when you realize that consciousness has this nature, knowing, has this nature. Normally, it's very. Some people don't have a sense of it because we take this stuff to be the movie. We kind of have a gestalt picture of it all, and we hold it all as a unified field, which is a fine thing to do. But when the mind gets really, really focused and concentrated, you don't see it as a unified field, but you see it as, you know, this arising and passing of phenomena, rising and passing of phenomena. So in seeing that, what remains is equanimity. So it would really see this, really live in this, really kind of be present for the rising and passing. Really takes a lot of concentration. See, just really see the rising, passing or phenomena, the knowing rises and passing. Then the mind gets very equanimous. Equanimous here means it doesn't go towards or away from anything. It's not, doesn't prefer one thing over the other. The mind just is. Then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Suppose a skilled goldsmith or his apprentice were to prepare a furnace, heat up the crucible, take some gold with thongs, and put it into the crucible. From time to time he would blow on it, from time to time he would sprinkle water over it, and from time to time he would just look on. That gold would become refined, well refined, completely refined, faultless, rid of dross, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Then whatever kind of ornament he wishes to make from it, whether a golden chain or earrings or a necklace or a golden garland, it should serve his purpose. So too, there then remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. What a phenomenally positive view of the human heart and mind. Isn't that something? It's kind of like saying in its essence, it's like pure gold. Do you imagine that's in you? There's gold in you? Just a few little bit of impurities that need to be kind of worked out. And, you know, IRC is the furnace. You know, hang out here long enough, you'll get soft. We'll soften you up. If I take a little side trip, when my son was in kindergarten, once a week they had this practice or this thing they did, a lesson they did at school, which all the kids would go to the shelf and pull down the beeswax. And the beeswax, they were going to make beeswax clay figurines kind of thing. And the beeswax would be cold. And cold beeswax is hard, and you can't do anything with it. You can break it maybe, but you can't. It's just, you can't do anything with it. So the teacher would have the kids put the beeswax in the palm of their hand between the two palms and hold it there, and then the teacher would tell them a story. And when the story was done, the beeswax was soft, and then the kids would make beautiful things out of it. And then they relinquish the beautiful thing and put it on the shelf for next week. Sometimes that's what practice is, that we have something difficult, we have something going on, and it's very important to just hold it in the warmth of our care, the warmth of our compassion, the warmth of our presence. Sometimes it's we're too quick to want to fix and get. There's a lot that happens, just be patient to hold it, be there. Feel the warmth, feel that you be with it. And I think that the part of the advantage of concentration practice is that sometimes people are too quick to have the insights, to try to see and to understand, to fix. And concentration, you can't do concentration if you're trying to fix something. But it is creating a warmth, kind of a delight, a glow that softens and kind of is very nourishing and healing. It's kind of very, I think it was very compassionate, sitting in a field of compassion, holding it, and letting something thaw. And sometimes it takes a while for something to thaw, to soften up, and we have to give ourselves the time and the kindness to let things kind of, get soft. So here, in this analogy, it's purifying the gold. And then it talks about, with this equanimity, this pure, refined mind, equanimity, equanimous mind, kind of a description of the fourth jhana. And then it talks about then from there going into the next four jhanas, the four formless bases. But then it says, it gives a wisdom teaching, which I think is true for any state that we're in if we can do it. So one sees these states, as all states are, as conditioned, as constructed. They're conditioned. They come together because of causes and conditions. And then one does not form any mental constructs or any volition towards either being or not being, towards becoming or not becoming, towards wanting or not wanting, towards identifying or not identifying. One doesn't, when it stays in that equanimity, one sees it as conditioned, one sees it as a constructed activity, these states, and then one backs off and just lets it be and doesn't do anything at all. Just be. This is where the just being practice becomes very profound. And since he does not, since the person does not form any mental constructs or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being, the person does not cling to anything in this world. When the person does not cling, the person is not agitated. When the person is not agitated, the person personally attains release, personally attains freedom. But the word here, it's a kind of a noun, the word here, even though Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as, not, it's a verb, even though Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as a noun. It's the word he uses, nibbana, but many times in the sutta, nibbana is not a noun; it's a verb for release, or as Tanisra Bhikkhu translates it, as unbinding. It's a movement of freedom, and the person understands then: birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, and there's nothing further here. So in that ability to be equanimous and uninvolved with what's going on, not wanting or not wanting anything, not trying to become or not become, not have an identity or not have a non-identity, this ability at some point just let everything just be. But be it, let it be once you see it as just constructed, conditioned phenomena that arises in passing. At that point, the mind can become quiet, unagitated. And when the mind doesn't have any agitation in it whatsoever, the mind itself can release itself. I like to think of it as that consciousness lets go of itself. Isn't that great? Finally. Consciousness has been holding on to itself for a long time. Finally, consciousness gets to let go of itself. And this is the release. Therefore, in this way, a bhikkhu possesses the supreme foundation of wisdom. Remember, there are four foundations or four determinations. One is that this is the supreme noble wisdom, namely the knowledge of the ending of all suffering. So the ultimate wisdom is to understand what leads to the ending of suffering. And here the word is all suffering. It's a phenomenal experience, phenomenal thing to have anything and everything that's connected to suffering, have it fall away, have it be released. To just kind of look around and see it gone. It's possible. And it's even more impressive for someone who's done Buddhist practice for a while, because then you really know you're suffering. I don't think you can really know how much you're suffering until you've practiced for a while. I mean, conventional suffering maybe you can know really well, but there's something about understanding suffering which, you know, I blew my socks off when I realized it. Wow, I had no idea how pervasive, how complete, how thorough it was. I mean, it just blew my socks off, literally. Not literally, but just about. I don't think I was wearing socks. I was in Burma. It was hot, but I remember the moment. But the contrast of having, you know, this being my mind blown, at least by the pervasiveness, the radical, the pervasive, the how much suffering there is, was this is part of the advantage of concentration practice. I had so much joy. The context of seeing it was in a field of well-being, of joy, of delight. And so I had the joy that could hold seeing suffering in this profound way. And it's possible to be free. It isn't that you suffer more because of Buddhism. I hope you don't. It's to realize what's really here, so you can go beyond it, you can become free of it. We're not here to mindfully accept our life just as it is so we can suffer better. Please don't. There really is a path to freedom. So this is wisdom, the real wisdom, the determination for that wisdom, the resolve, the direction. That's fundamental to the holy life. That's fundamental to this path. The wisdom for the knowledge of the ending of all suffering. That person's deliverance is also founded upon truth, is unshakable. For that is false which has a deceptive nature, and that is true which has an undeceptive nature. So here, to be resolved upon truth, that which is undeceptive, what's ultimately true, and here you have to kind of go along with maybe a little spin on the word truth. Truth here is not a thing or a statement or a belief, but what's ultimately true is the release of Nibbana. That release, that relinquishment, letting go of clinging, that movement of letting go. So if I'm holding on to this really tight, and saying this striker is the only thing that's true, you know, that we can get into the philosophy of what's true and what isn't true, and should it be the striker that's true, or should it be the bell that's true, or is it the striking of the striker against the bell that's true? What's really true? Who knows? But the important truth to resolve on is the truth that happens when we let go, and I feel the freedom, the lightness, the openness of my hand. That is not deceptive. You're not deceived by the freedom from suffering, the release that comes from clinging. That's something you can know. And that's not deceptive, that knowing of that release. And that saves you from having to take a philosophy class about, you know, what's true. It's just that movement. So be resolved on that. And then, formerly, when that person was ignorant, the person undertook and took on acquisitions. I think it means mental acquisitions. We acquired things, acquired knowledge, identities, status, all kinds of things we acquired. But now, the person has abandoned those acquisitions, cut them at the root, done away with them so they no longer arise again. By this way, the person possesses the supreme foundation of relinquishment. So the idea of relinquishment I talked about before. So let go of the acquisitions. What we acquire. So you have to kind of a little bit play with it, what it means. But how many times are you caught up in what you're acquiring things in your mind, wanting to be a certain way in your mind? No need to be anything. So we let go of, we relinquish the holding. And then the final foundation or final determination is in relinquishment, the mind is no longer caught in lust, hate, and delusion. And when there is no lust, no hate, and no delusion, then there's peace. And that's the fourth of the four determinations, that of peace, supreme peace. So this process of nibbanizing, remember it's a verb, releasing, and releasing the acquisitions, releasing our clinging and holding, then helps us to release the impulses towards lust, greed, the impulses to hate, impulses to delusion. And without those three, the mind has no waves, has no cause to get agitated. And it's quite something, it's really something to understand that the agitation of the mind is all within the mind. So we don't blame the world around us for what goes on in our own minds. We don't look for the world around us to be the solution to what goes on in our minds. Remember Pukkasati, this monk, was sat up through the night, mature, energized, concentrated. He was a mature person. He was ready for this kind of teaching. He was ready in a way that many people are not, because they're not ready. He was ready to take responsibility for his own mind and to realize it's all the agitation, and the freedom from agitation all happens in this heart, in this mind. So sitting quiet and still, seeing the arising and passing of the elements or direct experience, by not making any stories, not overlaying ideas on top of what the experience is, to see the arising and passing of consciousness, to become equanimous about this, begin to let go of what we cling to. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations, these determinations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over that person, the person is called a sage at peace. With reference to what was this said? I am is a conceiving. I am this is a story. I shall be is a story. I shall not be is a story. I shall be possessed of form is a story. I shall be formless is a story. I shall be conscious is a story. I shall be non-conscious is a story. I shall be neither conscious nor non-conscious is a story. Consciousness, stories are a dart. By overcoming all stories, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. The sage at peace is not shaken and does not yearn. For there is nothing present in that person by which he or she might be born. Not being born, how could he or she age? Not aging, how could there be death? Not dying, how could there be shakiness? Not being shaken, how can there be yearning? So soon thereafter, Pukkasati became awakened. So there certainly is one point of view where there is aging, old age, illness, death, and all those things. And it's important to spend time being mature and engaged in it. But one of the reasons to the reflections that Lee gave you is so that you are inspired to do the work to see, to find here and now the other perspective, the perspective that comes when we don't have a perspective, when we don't make a story. And then there is no aging, there's no birth, there's no dying. It's a place where you don't have a face, you don't have a body, you don't have a history, you don't have a need, where you're never threatened. You're safe, you're home, you're at peace. So, venerable ones, the Buddha said of Pukkasati, this person conducts himself in a way that inspires confidence. I want to thank you for this week so far. The way you've conducted yourselves has inspired confidence. It's been beautiful, wonderful what you've done. It's a great thing to practice like this and to engage in this. I believe everyone is sincere and does in their way what they can do, what's best for them and finding their way. And maybe if you sit up tonight a little bit longer than usual into the night, who knows, maybe you'll have the company. Maybe you'll have the company of the Blessed One. Maybe you won't recognize him or her, but we'll see. So let's take a minute to sit.